This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is Bobby Thigpen, card number 613, pitcher for the Chicago White Sox.
Okay. Bobby Thigpen, I'm looking forward to this one. We also have a guest we'll talk about in a moment. But first, we have follow-up on Pat Tabler.
Matt, we asked the question, Pat Tabler, was this a painted cap? And we got from the foremost authority on painted caps. Andrew said he thought that this Pat Tabler card was real, was not an airbrushed card. But we also referenced Tommy Hutton. Tommy Hutton was a Blue Jays announcer for a long time, and he was also part of the reason why Pat Tabler ended up in the booth for so long with the Toronto Blue Jays. And Andrew sent along this beautiful Tommy Hutton card from 1978 Hostess, where Tommy has a painted cap, but also the most outrageous mustache I have seen since Yosemite Sam.
This mustache doesn't look real. This looks like a painted stash. Like, how is it possible that his mustache went all the way around, like up that high on his cheek? It doesn't seem...
This is Canadian mustache technology that we have not seen. We had some other Pat Tabler-related news. Mims bands, famous for making wristbands with people's faces on them, like Dusty Baker and Eric Davis, they made a Pat Tabler Mims band, which I knew that Mims bands only supplied the coolest of players with wristbands. I don't know what to say about this Pat Tabler Mims band. He looks clear. This is a frightening depiction of Pat Tabler.
Yeah, his hair, his skin, his teeth are all kind of the same color. It does not really inspire much enthusiasm with the design.
But Pat got a new job recently. He was hired as the new announcer for the Guardians. So good to see Pat Tabler after 20 plus years of working for the Blue Jays getting back on the air now in Cleveland.
Great job, Pat. So now let's go to this week's card and Bobby Thigpen. And why are we talking about Bobby today?
For the last few years, I have followed on Twitter the Last Comiskey Twitter account. And this was an account created, I think, in 2020 that just showed some videos and facts and pictures about the old Comiskey Park, the White Sox stadium of my youth that I remember going to throughout the 1980s. But this Twitter account is dedicated particularly to the final year of that stadium, which was 1990. And we have brought on a guest here, the director, creator, producer, documentarian of Last Comiskey, who just finished the creation of a three-part documentary miniseries on YouTube that I have seen all over the news, both here in Chicago and nationally, about that last season. And so, Matt Flesch, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. I've been a fan of your podcast and really appreciate your bringing me on.
This documentary has gotten a lot of views on YouTube. I was amazed at how many people, not just White Sox fans, have seen this, have been bumping this. Why did you decide to make this documentary and dedicate so much time to this?
I always loved that 1990 team, and I also always just loved Comiskey Park. You know, when I was a kid, I used to just draw pictures of Comiskey Park in class and stuff. I loved the way the upper decks were in the outfield. So it's kind of just something that's been with me always, like my baseball fandom. You know, it's always gone back to like that 1990 team is sort of the type of team that I love more than anything, with the stealing bases, hitting doubles and triples, playing awesome defense. And then you add the backdrop of this awesome, old, iconic, unique carnival-like stadium. It just always like stuck in my head. Like, I love this place. And so then with the pandemic, watched The Last Dance with my brother Mike, who was a collaborator on this. And we loved The Last Dance. And so we were thinking, you know, what are some other great Chicago stories? Of course, 1990 is one we always thought about that deserved a documentary, but they don't make a lot of documentaries about teams that finished in second place. And so we thought, hey, if we're going to see this thing, why don't we try and do it ourselves? And we had time because of the pandemic. We had, you know, nights and weekends and things where I'd normally be doing all kinds of stuff with my wife and daughter, you know, just less to do. So just kind of started fiddling around with making some videos, started posting those to YouTube. And that's where we got the attention of Nancy Faust. Ozzie Guillen, you know, would say like, great job, bro, on some of them. And then they started to be willing to interview with us, and it just snowballed from there. And it's been just a passion project, never something that we thought would make money, and always just something that we thought would be super fun to get out there.
This is a really well-made documentary. It includes a lot of clips, interviews, as you said, and it's really, really well-made. Basically, 30 for 30 ESPN quality documentary. What is your filmmaking background that led to this really polished product?
Thank you so much for saying that. That means a lot to hear that, because it's Zoom interviews for the most part, and 30 to 40 to 50 year old, you know, video. So it's tough to piece all of that together and try and make it something that is watchable. And I would say my background is I work in healthcare communications for a biotechnology company in the Chicago area. And I do some video there, but really it's not my job. I'm just around people who do video. So I picked up a little bit from their expertise. A few people that I work with have worked like on the Oprah show before. So I got some ideas and I was able to see, okay, how are they editing things? What are they taking out? What are they leaving in to keep things flowing and keep your attention? But then I also had some great collaborators. Tom Scherer, longtime Chicago sportscaster. I think he was the first guy on The Score. He actually gave us notes and really helped with the edit. And then two fantastic local Chicago film people. One is Mark Bandy, who did the sound, which is so key to this because it's really trying to capture the sound of the organ and the crowd and Andy the Clown and all these things that are going on. And then also Pete Giannotto was our colorist, who it was probably the toughest job he ever had to try and bring out the color in a lot of that old footage and in some of the Zoom stuff and make it look cohesive.
Well, it definitely brought back memories for me of going to the old park and the juxtaposition of the old park and the new park, which I think I have lamented about the new park on this podcast before. Still my team, but not necessarily the home that the old Comiskey was. What was it specifically about that old park that made it so special, even though I think, as I said on the Dan Pascoe episode, it was smelly and dirty and not necessarily the best sight lines? And what was it about that park that made it so special for you?
100%. It was not without its issues. And some players like Lance Johnson did not beat around the bush. He just straight up said that place was a dump. Okay. It was a dump. And he even said like, it looked cool, but I was excited to get out of there. But yeah, what made Comiskey Park special as a fan is, if you remember walking up to the stadium, it almost looked like it was like a warehouse. It just didn't look like a stadium. So it kind of had this intrigue just even from the outside. And then you walk in and you have these dark concourses and you have the smell of old beer and hot dogs and grilled onions. And it just smelled like a ballpark. It smelled like an old mitt that you've had for, you know, 10, 15 years since you were a kid. It was just like, this is baseball. The smell, the Nancy on the organ. And then, you know, you walk in and the way that old Comiskey Park was set up is the stands were right on the field. Like if you were in the upper deck, like you were right on the field, even in the outfield. Nowadays, not just the new Sox park, every new park, they have three or four levels of suites in the upper deck is like pushed so far away. I was just listening to my interview with Bobby Thigpen and he specifically said the old park, it was so loud because you felt like the fans were with you on the field. And at the new park, it kind of felt like they were pushed away from you. All those things made Comiskey Park a truly special place. It wasn't just the game on the field. It was everything happening around you in this kind of circus environment.
Well, you mentioned that Bobby Thigpen was interviewed for the documentary. And so among many, many other players that I think of along with Comiskey Park, when I think of 1990 and that final season, one of the big names that I think of is Bobby Thigpen, the closer for that 1990 team. He set a record in 1990. And so we thought no better reason to have you on than to talk about the record breaker, Bobby Thigpen. So Matt, should we get into this card?
Yeah, let's go to the front of 613 and we have Bobby Thigpen. It's spring. The sun's in his eyes. The hair's kind of poking out of that hat. He's got the red mesh warm-up shirt. But he's got a good smile. He looks clean shaven. He looks really good here.
Yeah, this is a good picture. It is a very sunny day. He looks a little bit sunburned, but I like this picture. I do like this red mesh top with the block socks lettering on it. I think that's a good look. But the mixture of the two uniform styles is a little bit jarring. I think that this was only a spring training look, and they had switched the hat fully to the script, but not switched all of the other uniforms. He looks young. I think he was 24 in this picture.
Let's go to the back of 613. We have Bobby Thigpen, pitcher, 6'3", 195, right-handed batter and thrower, drafted by the White Sox in the fourth round of 1985. Born July 17th, 1963 in Tallahassee, Florida, with a home in Monticello, Florida.
The back of this card is actually like the perfect 1988 Topps card. We've got some stats. We've got some minor league stats. We also have a fun fact and a This Way to the Clubhouse. So we got everything that we could want. And that name, Thigpen, that's an interesting name. From a definitely legitimate 1997-looking early website where you can order a coat of arms, I found Son of Thigfens as the origin of Thigpen. One who was thrifty and swift, also spelt Thigpen, Thigpenny, and Thickpenny. There is a record of a Leonard Thigpenny in 1590, minister of Enfield, who was brought from the King's Bench in a coffin with a flap open with a writing on it in verse laid at Leadenhall Gates by night at St. Peter Cornhill, London. I don't know if Bobby Thigpen is related to Leonard Thigpenny. Also could be of German origin, but we got some fourcrests.com. Hopefully they get some ad revenue from all of the many listeners who are going to be visiting that website. Bobby was born in Tallahassee, the capital of Florida. But he grew up in Jefferson County, which is a small county, about 10,000 people, with one major town, quote-unquote major town, that's Monticello. In the last Comiskey documentary, Thigpen said that he and the clubhouse man Chicken Willie shared the same hometown of Monticello, or Monticello, and there's 2,500 people in that town. Matt F., anything fun about Chicken Willie? He seemed like a character.
Bobby Thigpen really was close with Chicken Willie, I think, because they had that. They being both from the same hometown. And it was one of the things that when I interviewed the players as a fan, I was always really a little bit starstruck because this is like all of a sudden I turned into my 15-year-old self again, interviewing these guys that were my heroes. And so when I spoke with Ozzy pretty early on, he just, you know, unaided went into talking about Chicken Willie and just had all these stories. And he's this iconic guy and I loved them and everybody loved them. So one of the things I did to kind of diffuse the situation with my own nerves is I would start every interview from that point forward with a player with like, tell me about Chicken Willie. And so that was kind of like an unexpected first question that they didn't see coming because he's kind of a deep cut, like more of a somebody who the players would really know, but not so much a fan. And so that's where I started with Bobby Thigpen. And he had a lot of stories about Chicken Willie, just how he was always upbeat and always in a good mood and would write Monticello on everything, all of Bobby's stuff, and that he would take naps and that was the only time not to bother Chicken Willie. Like some of the stories were funny too. Like he would take a nap and he had like a little area where he'd lay down and take a nap. And if you messed with him when he was sleeping, that was the only time you would see an angry Chicken Willie. But yeah, I love that kind of stuff and cooking, you know, fried chicken and hot dogs wrapped in bacon and in the dugout. It was pretty cool to think that's how it was back in 1990. Whereas today, you know, everybody's got a dietitian and Ozzie Guillen said these clubhouses actually have restaurants. So like back in 1990, it's, you know, a little hole in the wall with Chicken Willie making these comfort foods. So I love that. I love that stuff.
So while they shared this quote unquote hometown, I think that Bobby was from an even smaller place that's not even listed as a town. I think it's just a census designated area called Osceola. And in 2020, it had a population of 103. So I found this 1988 Chicago Tribune article that's basically about Bobby Thigpen, but more about his mom. His mom was Donna Joe. She raised him and said that Bobby's father left shortly after Bobby was born, and his promises of child support always exceeded the checks that were sent, even though her dad was the sheriff of the county. But things were different back then, and the county and the state didn't really step in to collect child support payments. So Donna Joe raised Bobby and four siblings and sent them all to a private school, basically by driving the bus for the private school. So she was the bus driver for Osceola Christian Academy, as well as running a small convenience store that was really the only store in that small town. So Donna Joe, we talk about great moms on this one. And from this article, Donna Joe seemed like a real great one. Osceola Christian Academy is a really small school, so Bobby was one of only 35 in his graduating class. He played baseball, basketball, football, led the baseball team to the state title as a shortstop. And when he was getting ready to graduate from high school, there weren't any scouts looking at him. He had a couple community college options. He borrows his grandma's car, drives to three different community colleges. They went to St. John's River Community College at 10 a.m., Valencia Community College at 1 p.m., and Seminole Community College at 3 p.m. I did look at this map to make sure that this was drivable in one day, and it looks like it was. But by the time he gets to that last tryout, Bobby is tired. He tells the coach, "Do you want to see me pitch?" The coach said, "Don't worry about it," offered him a spot on the team right there. So Bobby decided to go to Seminole State Community College. Similar to his university decision, Bobby appreciated when somebody asked him to be on their team. And when they showed the initiative that they wanted him, it seemed like Bobby really took that and accepted that and said, "This is a place where I want to be because they want me there." So at that Seminole State College, other alumni include Hardy Rawls, best known as the dad from the TV show Pete and Pete, a forgotten 1988 Topps Canadian, Rob Ducey, umpire Ed Hickox, two-time All-Star batting champ, three-time stolen base champ, and son of Tom Flash Gordon, D. Strange Gordon, and also comedy writer for SNL and 30 Rock and creator of Debbie Downer, Paul Appel. So good alumni list from this state college. After two solid seasons, Bobby finally has some interest from big-time programs, including those in Florida, but also throughout the South. He visited Mississippi State in Starkville, Mississippi. He said he liked that town. He said, "I'm from a very small town, so it felt like being back home. The people were so great. It made it a very easy adjustment for me." He also liked Coach Ron Polk. In Polk's career, he coached in the SEC for 31 seasons and remains at Mississippi State as a special assistant to the athletic director. He took three different schools to the College World Series, including Mississippi State, six times, two-time Coach of the Year, inducted into the College Baseball Hall of Fame in 2009. And Bobby said, "I picked Mississippi State because Coach Polk picked me. He was the first one to really show interest in me, and he was the first one to offer me a scholarship." And he said that the local papers were mad because he didn't go to Florida State. And he said he would have gone, but they didn't call him. Mississippi State did, and so it was an easy call for him.
In 1984, playing in the outfield, he hit .276 with eight homers. He was overshadowed by teammates Rafael Palmeiro and Will Clark, but Bobby had a solid season, and the team went 45-16 and played in the NCAA regionals. Bobby was often a DH at this time, but doesn't show up on the pitching stat line at all. In 1985, the Diamond Dogs were even better, going 50-15. Palmeiro and Will Clark were still there and dominant at the plate. And the pitching staff had future major leaguer Jeff Brantley.
Bobby at this time is finally listed as a pitcher, but he also played in the outfield. He ended up playing in 65 games, every game for the Mississippi State Dogs. 27 of those were as a relief pitcher. He hit .306 in the outfield and had a .409 on-base percentage, both of those better than Rafael Palmeiro. Will Clark hit a very nice .420 with a ridiculous 1.392 OPS. Bobby didn't have the power of Clark and Palmeiro, but he did hit 9 home runs, so a really good hitting outfielder. And on the mound, he had 7 saves and a 3.43 ERA, struck out 49 in 42 innings, so a two-way player for a very good college baseball team.
They made it to the College World Series and were playing really well, making it into the main bracket, the upper final. Against Texas, they're up 3-0, and then their starter got hit with a line drive in the leg, knocking him out, and Texas came back and won the game 12-7. This forced Mississippi State to play the next day in the semifinal elimination game against Miami. Brantley was on only 3 days rest and called into service. Brantley gave up a few runs and wasn't as dominant as he had been throughout the regular season. But Bobby Thigpen ends up playing a major role. He hits a grand slam to make the score 5-4, with Mississippi State leading 5-4 in the bottom of the ninth.
And in the bottom of the ninth, Jeff Brantley walks the leadoff batter. Bobby is now moved to the pitching mound to come in for the save. And unfortunately, Miami catcher Greg Elena hit a walk-off home run to knock the Dogs out of the College World Series. Thigpen went from hero to goat in one pitch, giving up that walk-off home run. And this team has been called one of the great what-ifs in Mississippi State and college sport history. Bobby said, "I don't want to take anything away from anyone who ever wore the uniform, including our first national champions, but I feel like we had the best team. We were the best team. We just didn't win it all."
Can you imagine, like, That story is insane. He hits a grand slam home run to put them ahead. And then he goes out, plays left field, comes in for the save. It's just like you don't see that anymore. In talking to Bobby about this team, he hit fifth on that team behind Palmeiro and Clark. And I said, you were an awesome hitter. And he was like, no, I wasn't an awesome hitter. Those guys were an awesome hitter. And he said, like, you know, every once in a while he'd have guys on base because hitting fifth behind those guys, they cleaned everything up. But he did talk about that. He just said, you know, that was a pitch that didn't come back, you know, that pitch that he threw. So I think it still eats at him.
That great team after that 1985 season, most of the team gets drafted. Clark and Palmeiro go in the first round. Clark second overall, Palmeiro 22nd. Bobby went in the fourth round before even Jeff Brantley, who was the star pitcher of that team, who went in the sixth. Three other Mississippi State players were drafted. Gator Thiessen, that's a great name. Dan Van Cleve and Gene Morgan.
And that takes us to the This Way to the Clubhouse that Bobby signed as a fourth round draft selection with the White Sox, June 15th, 1985, by scout Ken Stauffer.
I don't have any Ken Stauffer facts. I'm sorry.
Well, Bobby was sent to low A ball, and we can see that first line on the card of Niagara Falls, where he had a 1.72 ERA and 74 strikeouts in 52 innings. He did pitch one game at Double A Appleton that year as well. Going into 1986, the Sox didn't rule him out making the team out of spring training, but he started the season at Double A Birmingham as a starter this time. The Sox wanted him to get more innings because he hadn't been a full-time pitcher since high school. He made 25 starts for the Barons, going 8-11 with a 4.68 ERA in 159 innings.
Bobby said, it didn't bother me, but in today's world, they wouldn't be allowed to do that. He said it did help him. He needed to know how to throw other pitches. And so Bobby was a different kind of closer. He threw multiple pitches. He didn't just have one out pitch. And he got called up straight from Birmingham to Chicago at the beginning of August 1986. Matt, what kind of teams were these mid-80s White Sox teams that you and I grew up watching that Bobby was joining?
They were teams that struggled, for sure. I mean, they were disappointing teams. After that 83 year, it was like one disappointment after the other. With the exception of 1985, they won like 80-something games. That was kind of a fun year. But otherwise, they were teams that just struggled a lot. But in talking with Bobby for this project, one of the things on that 1986 team, he went to spring training and he was able to spend 2 weeks there before they sent him down. And so they had some players that had a huge impact on him. So Carlton Fisk, Tom Seaver, Harold Baines, Ron Kittle. And he talked about being really quiet and shy in at spring training and like when he came up to the team in 1986. But that those guys were all very nice to him and that he learned a lot early going from like these legends of the game that he was able to play with.
So he comes up and makes his debut at Fenway Park. The White Sox are 10 games under 500. They're down 7-0, and Bobby's called in the sixth inning. He pitches two scoreless innings before giving up two in the eighth.
So he got called up to pitch and he went to the bullpen and he was so excited the night before he didn't take his contacts out and he slept with his contacts on. And he came up to the team and his quote, he was like, I was so stupid, I thought I'd be the closer, like in my first game. So I was sitting around in the bullpen thinking, you know, getting a little bit loose, but they're not going to bring me in. And the phone rang in the sixth inning and then they're bringing him in and he's very nervous. And then he can't see because of his contacts. And he went in to pitch to Carlton Fisk. And I guess he crossed up Carlton Fisk like three times on the first batter. And Fisk walks out and is just, you know, what is this young guy doing? Like, does he not know how to read signs? And Thigpen explained that he couldn't see the sign because he couldn't see. He could only see, you know, it's blurry. So they came up with where Fisk said, all right, if I put down a fist, it's a fastball. And if I give you all five fingers, it's like the off speed. He actually pitched pretty good considering he couldn't really see in that first game.
He went on a fantastic run of 15 games where he didn't give up a single earned run. And thank you to @SoxNerd on Twitter, who had a good post of fun facts, including that Bobby's first big league save preserved Steve Carlton's first American League win on August 17th, 1986. Steve Carlton and Bobby Thigpen threw to Ron Karkovice, who was making his big league debut. Ron Karkovice, assuredly at that point, was only 45 years old. During that 15-game stretch, Bobby only allowed a 1.14 average to opponents and a 3.37 OPS, earning seven saves in the process. He closed out the season with four blown saves in a row, getting a win in this final appearance, but he still finished the season with a 1.77 ERA in 35 innings.
Heartwarming story. Mom Donna Jo got to see him pitch. Bobby bought her a plane ticket, and she said it was her first and last plane ride she would ever take, mostly because her best friend May Lou had a satellite dish. So Donna Jo said she'll telephone and tell me that they just showed Bobby warming up in the bullpen, that the White Sox are in the eighth inning or whatever, and I'll run up there to her house and watch him. She'll maybe be standing on the front porch yelling for me to hurry, that Fregosi's just taken out the starter. Bobby's coming in to pitch. We do that all the time.
Well, I imagine in looking at the town of Osceola on the map, you could probably run across the town and it wouldn't take you very long during a commercial break. So as long as May Lou calls you in time, you got time to run across town. Headed into that 1987 season, Bob James was supposed to be the White Sox closer. Bobby started out as a late game option in losing situations. He pitched okay. He got one save, ERA in the mid threes. But then thanks to some questionable White Sox decision-making in late May, Bobby was sent down to AAA to get some more time as a starting pitcher. And GM Larry Hines said he's really not getting enough pitches for a guy his age to find out what kind of pitcher he is capable of becoming. And Bobby said, I got sent there to be his starter, but this time it was legitimate and to develop more pitches to be a projected starter. I think they seriously wanted me to be a starter. It just didn't work out. He went 2-3 with an ERA over 6 in 9 starts. So starting pitching was not necessarily Bobby's forte.
So at the end of 87, Bob James gets injured and Bobby got called back up. From that point through the end of the season, he pitched in 34 games, 55 innings with a 2.26 ERA and 15 saves, setting him up very nicely for 1988 for him to be the closer. But he struggled in the beginning of 1988. In his first 20 games, his ERA was over 5. The White Sox were kind of unclear about what would happen with Bobby that year.
And they were unclear about where they would play in the future. At this point, they're still at Old Comiskey Park. As we know, they've got 2 seasons left there because the final season was 1990. We talked a little bit about our memories of the old park. Matt, anything to add about famous events, favorite stories about the old park, characters, and what was happening with the team in the stadium around this time?
Comiskey Park has so much history. And if you look back at like the teams that my dad always told me about that he grew up with, the 1950s and 60s White Sox, the Go-Go White Sox with Nellie Fox, Louis Aparicio, so many people, their fandom started with that group of teams that they would win 95 games every single year. Unfortunately, you had the Yankees also in the American League, so they only made the World Series one year in 1959. And then I think after the 60s, they really took a fall. The teams got bad and the attendance really went down. But 1972, they got Dick Allen. And so there's these years in Sox history that are really memorable years. And Dick Allen is somebody who the White Sox got him in a trade and he just turned things around at Comiskey Park. They went from barely having 10,000 people there to selling out. It was a huge event. Dick Allen was an absolute superstar. Nancy Faust started playing Jesus Christ Superstar. And then you got 1977 was the other year where they had the Southside Hitmen. But other than those 2 years, like the 70s were pretty bad. And then Reinsdorf and Einhorn bought the team, I think it was 80 or 81. And they put a lot of money into the park trying to fix it up, trying to make it more modern. And they came to the realization, I think, after talking to a variety of different architects that the best thing to do was to build a new stadium. So the undercurrent, a lot of those late 80s teams is what's going to happen with this team. There was a lot of rumor that they might move to Florida. And that was upsetting to this fan base because to imagine them not being there anymore as a fan, it's heartbreaking to think about that. So I'm not an expert on all the politics that occurred with the stadium.
I am.
Are you? Okay. Yeah.
So for that legislative history, you can welcome to my other area of expertise beyond worthless baseball cards is Illinois legislative process. I actually teach a continuing legal education course on advocacy in Springfield. I'm sure there's other podcasts that we can direct you to about former Illinois Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, the longtime Democratic Speaker of the House and White Sox fan, now currently under indictment on corruption charges. And there's a lot of news about Mike Madigan. Just search the Chicago Tribune. But in 1988, there was this real chance that the White Sox were going to leave. I remember talking with my dad about it and people saying, you know, it's going to be the St. Pete Sox. The White Sox were looking for state funding for a new stadium. At the time, you have the Democratic Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, and the Republican governor, Jim Thompson, both wanted to get this done. So today in Illinois, the legislative session, the regular legislative session ends on June 1st, which is why between January and May, we have diminishing returns on the quality of our episodes, because that is the busy time for me at work. But in the 80s, the legislative session ended July 1st. And for Illinois constitutional reasons, after midnight on June 30th, you have to get a 3/5 majority vote to pass a legislative measure. So going into June 30th, 1988, the White Sox are looking for a hotel tax levy that would only apply in the city of Chicago and would generate $150 million to pay for a new stadium, or else they would move to St. Petersburg. So it looked like they had 50 of the 60 necessary votes, but if it goes past midnight, they would need 71 votes. So on the floor, you have this bipartisan team of Madigan and Governor Thompson corralling votes. The clock hits midnight, and after midnight, you need a greater majority, but a vote was called, and a vote of 60 to 55 passed this funding proposal for the new stadium. So live on the air, you have this reporter from St. Petersburg, Florida, who was sitting at the Illinois State House ready to announce that Illinois had not passed a funding bill, that St. Petersburg is ready to welcome the White Sox. Mark Douglas, this reporter, says, the news anchor at the time says, "Mark, help me out. I thought the vote had to be made by midnight." But sure enough, the clock in the chamber was stuck a few minutes before midnight. And so Mike Madigan stopped the clock and kept the White Sox in Chicago. It had not met the deadline. And Mike Madigan said, "My watch said 11:59. And when asked about the legality of this legislative maneuver, he said, "I don't think there's a judge in the nation, especially in Illinois, who would challenge this." There was opposition to the bill, even from Chicago Democrats, including Senator Richard Newhouse, who said that he was a reluctant supporter of the bill because it was hollow, because education reform had failed. So the state of Illinois just voted to build a new stadium. You can see my other podcast, The Dome Zone, to talk about other legislative issues.
Luckily for 1988 David and Matt growing up, they may not have had the school funding that they deserved, but they could look forward to a new stadium for their childhood
priorities.
Team.
Priorities, yeah.
Priorities were in order. 1988, the Sox were a 90-plus loss team, sadly, but Bobby Thigpen did turn his year around. From the 21st game on, his ERA was under 2.5. He saved 28 more games, finishing the season with a Sox team record 34 saves. Overall, a 3.3 ERA and a 121 ERA plus. Not dominant, but a good closer on a bad team.
1989, the Sox again lose 90 games and Bobby saves 34. His ERA ticked up slightly, which was 3.76, right around the league average. But he was giving up fewer hits, but more home runs. 10 homers compared to 6 in 1988. And that takes us to 1990. I don't quite remember what my expectations were of this White Sox team. I don't think I knew their win-loss. I knew that they like weren't winning titles, but I wasn't sure how bad they were. Matt, can you tell us about the expectations for this White Sox team heading into 1990 in the final year at the old Comiskey Park?
Chicago was Cubs crazy going into 1990, because in 89 they went to the playoffs against the Giants, and people thought with Jerome Walton and Dwight Smith that the Cubs were just going to be a dynasty for the whole, you know, early 90s, and the White Sox were a complete afterthought. It was hard to even find an article about them in the paper. It was all Cubs. So in going into that year, yes, there was the awareness that they had these draft picks that seemed pretty promising, with Jack McDowell, Robin Ventura, Frank Thomas, Alex Fernandez. So we knew we had that to look forward to. It's always exciting when you got a new guard that's coming in that's supposed to be really good. But other than that, all the predictions were last place. Last place, and maybe if somebody was nice, second to last. But this team had zero expectations to compete.
And we know that all of those expectations, at least from Sports Illustrated, they always come true. Cleveland won the 1987 World Series. Dan Pascal was the home run champ. But the White Sox in the AL West were going up against the Oakland A's. They had gone to the World Series in 88 and 89. And the Sox come into the season and they start giving them a run for their money, finishing the first half of the season 48 and 30. They were in and out of first place. Bobby had 27 saves with a 1.93 ERA at the All-Star break. He's on track to blow away the saves record of 46 set by Dave Rigetti in 1986. He goes into the All-Star game, pitches a scoreless inning for a hold in a 2-0 AL win.
He pitched against Will Clark in that game, which I thought was kind of interesting. I think he got Will Clark to ground out to Ozzie Guillen, possibly, if I remember that correctly. So it was neat to see him facing his old teammate.
In the second half of the season, the Sox were still very good, going 46 and 38, but could not keep up that torrid pace of the first half. There were a couple short losing streaks that allowed the A's to maintain their lead and eventually extend it to 9 games. But the White Sox finished with 94 victories, really an astonishing feat considering the expectations of the team going into that season.
So we talked about the Oakland A's. What I didn't realize was the depth of dislike between these teams. Did Bobby have any comments about that?
Those two teams started out with the A's not even taking the White Sox even seriously. They were a team that got off to a hot start that I don't think the A's thought would be around much past May. So I don't think that they really acknowledged that the Sox were good. And if you look at like the newspaper clippings after like the first A's Sox series, the A's won 3 of 4, but there was nothing to where they thought that they were actually going to be a challenger. So then when the White Sox went out to Oakland for a 3-game series later on in the month, they go in there, they're down like 4 games and they sweep the A's. And they actually, then they went out and they swept the Angels. But after that A's sweep, the A's started to get really irritated with the White Sox. I think the White Sox, they were a young team, a cocky team. They had people like Steve Lyons, who you may remember, and Jack McDowell. Like, these were people who just, they expected to win, and they were loud, and they would talk some smack. And I think Dave Stewart, he lost a game. He actually pitched 10 innings, and he threw like 160 pitches, like, which was kind of common back in those days. But he lost on a homer to Dan Pasqua. And in the locker room after the game, I think he was still really fired up about the loss, and he was irritated because he was hearing chatter from the White Sox team that he thought was maybe not professional. At least that's how the legend goes. And he said nobody on that team, with the exception of Fisk, Kittle, and maybe Calderon, nobody else on that team could hold my jack. And what an awesome gift to White Sox fans that was. Like, I remember reading that and saying, this is the greatest thing ever. Like, I'm so happy he said that. It added such a charge to that summer. And then, you know, when the A's came back to Comiskey in August, the fans have giant jack straps that are hanging from the upper deck. They're throwing jack straps out on the field after Dave Stewart gets rocked by the Sox for an 11-1 loss. So, and I think that started a rivalry with the A's that continued into the early 90s. There were some really nasty games that you guys will probably get into later between the A's and the Sox that all stemmed from that rivalry.
Bobby Thigpen blew the save in that game that Stewart lost in 10 innings. One of a few blown saves that he had in this pretty outrageous record-breaking season. He recorded his 47th save in a 4-2 win on September 3rd. So he had a whole month left of the season, and he would get 10 more saves, becoming the first player to hit 50 in a season. According to Bobby, this is one of the few times that he showed a lot of emotion on the field. After that 50th save, he jumps up, gives a hug to Carlton Fisk, but then he kept it going and extended his record to 57 saves. The 57th was also the last game played at Comiskey Park, and Bobby recorded the last out in that stadium. Matt, I know you've talked a little bit about Nancy Faust, and we may have referenced her in the past because she's just a wonderful follow on Twitter, and part of the impetus behind this project was her excitement about it. Nancy had video from the final game. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of Nancy Faust, her importance in sports generally and Chicago history?
For sure. She came on the scene in 1970 and she was placed in the outfield in a little perch where they put the organ, and she had a very, you know, basic assignment, play the national anthem and, you know, maybe play the player's state song when they come up to hit. I think she really started making a name for herself when she started playing walk-up songs for players. And the first one that everybody really remembers is the Jesus Christ Superstar for Dick Allen. That was like a kind of almost like a shocking, like, we're playing Jesus Christ Superstar for this guy. And then she started doing that. Like, she invented the walk-up song. And then she also was the first person who would play the organ based on things that were happening on the field. For instance, the umpires would make a bad call for the White Sox and she'd play Three Blind Mice. So as a fan, you're just listening to what she's playing based on who's coming up and what the situation is. And it was really fun. And the other cool thing is she was like in the crowd, like where they ended up having her for most of the time that I remember, she would be in the upper deck, but she basically, her organ was like right among the seats. So if you had an idea, like if they're playing the A's and Jose Canseco's on the A's and he, you know, in the news, he's dating Madonna. You walk over to Nancy and say, hey, did you know Jose Canseco is dating Madonna? And she's like, oh, I didn't know that. And now she's playing Madonna songs when Jose Canseco comes up. Also, Nancy's just a super nice person. Just like, she's always positive. She's very welcoming to fans. She has time for everybody. She remembers your name. She remembers your kids' names. She's just a really special person that should always be remembered in Sox history and really Chicago history for that matter.
One maybe not quite so nice thing that Nancy did was she started playing Na Na, Hey Hey Goodbye.
Right.
And really made, in 1977, she started playing that song on the organ when the pitcher would get pulled, and that's become a thing. And it actually made the song a hit. This song came out in 1969, but didn't really become a hit until Nancy Faust and this organ kind of made it a hit.
Yeah, she got a gold record for making that song so popular. I think it was Mercury Records actually gave her a gold record for that. Can I give a little something about Bobby Thigpen in 1990? Interestingly about the 1990 White Sox is that's a team that won 94 games, but nobody had 100 RBI. Nobody hit 20 homers. They didn't even have a pitcher who won 15 games. That team did not have big stats. They were a team and everybody contributed, but there wasn't really a superstar except Bobby Thigpen. So nobody hits any of those, you know, traditional milestones that you think of on a great team, but Bobby Thigpen goes ahead and like blows it out of the water. And I think it really encapsulates what that team was, because they were doing the little things. So they won so many one run games, which then puts a person like Bobby Thigpen in all of these save situations, high pressure end of game situations. And the other, a cool story about Thigpen is that early on in the season, they were playing Texas, and he gave up a home run to lose the game in the ninth to Pete Incaviglia in Texas. And after the game, Torborg and Thigpen and others were just sitting on the bench. They were listening to the post-game show. It was either on the scoreboard or was playing somewhere in there. And Incaviglia made a comment in the post-game show, you know, when Thigpen comes up, it's easy. You just sit on his fastball. And up until that point, Thiggy was throwing a two-seam and a four-seam fastball, and he was getting guys out with it. So he really, that's just kind of what he did. And I guess when he heard Incaviglia say that, like his head jerked up, according to Torborg, and Thigpen talks about how he started to realize that he just can't go in with his fastball, that he's really got to start learning to throw the slider earlier in the count. And that's where he really started going to his slider. And I think it was the next game, Incaviglia came up and he threw him a first pitch slider to end the game with the ground out. So it was just kind of neat how that was like such a turning point. And the other thing about his arsenal and about throwing to Fisk, he never shook off Fisk in his entire career, ever. And one of the turning points of that 1990 season was playing the Angels. And it was a kind of a game where it's in the documentary where you think the Sox are going to turn it around. McDowell pitches a masterpiece. Thigpen comes up and Lee Stevens comes up to the plate and Fisk called for a changeup. And Lee Stevens hit a home run to win that game. And it was just a crushing blow. And in talking to Thigpen, he said, I never shook off Pudge, but maybe I should have shook him off on that changeup. But he said after the game, Fisk said, it was the right pitch. You just didn't locate it where I wanted it. And Thigpen is very deferential. And he agreed. He's like, Fisk was 100% right there. I just didn't execute the location.
Thigpen did make a few mistakes that season. He did have 8 blown saves, so he could have been the first to 60 saves as well. He was named the Rolaids Reliever of the Year and earned a 3-year, $9 million contract after that year, with 2 options for 1994 and 95.
After the season, Bobby went on an all-star tour of Japan, and while there he hurt his back and started having back spasms. Meanwhile, back in Chicago, Comiskey Park is closed, so what happened to it after the season?
So after the season, they started getting to work on tearing down the old Comiskey Park. And this was like a painful process as a fan, because it seemed like it took like a year to tear that thing down. They had chain link fence around it and like this big speedway wrecking, I remember, banner across this iconic old ballpark that's part of your heart. So it's like you're going to this new park, which, you know, especially in the early days, the new park was tough to swallow because it was pretty sterile. And you're looking across the street at this classic place with all this history and all these great players who played there. And now there's a huge open wound in it. And you're looking into the stadium and it's almost like you're exposing it. It just doesn't seem right. You're watching this thing that you love be slowly dismantled game by game across the street. You can hear in the wrecking ball hitting it. It was like kind of perverse in a way. And it took a while before that thing was leveled. And now it's the parking lot we see today.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Right in on, 1991, yeah. Bobby got the first save in the new park for the White Sox. The White Sox put together another second place season. This time they won 87 games with Frank Thomas, Robin Ventura, Tim Raines. During that season, Bobby continued that feud with the A's, and he hit Terry Steinbach in the head in 1991, an incident that led Tony La Russa to throw a bat and later shove a reporter who asked about the thrown bat. It's unclear if the pitch got away from Bobby. At this point, he was less effective. I don't think that he was a pitcher with a lot of hit-by-pitches, and as a closer, you wouldn't think putting guys on base would be a good option here, but his hit-by-pitches did go up later in his career. In 1989 and 90, he only hit one player in each of those seasons. He hit four in 1991, so his control was getting away from him a little bit at this point.
I think the pitch got away from him. I think there was a guy on second base, and it wasn't a situation where you would be throwing at somebody. So it doesn't seem like there's any way that Thigpen was actually thinking that he was going to, hey, I'm going to take this opportunity to hit Terry Steinbach. But we just had La Russa as the manager of the White Sox for a couple of years. And just throughout La Russa's career, his thinking on the subject is if you can command the fastball and your other pitches, then sure, you can throw inside. But if you're young and you don't know how to command your fastball, then you shouldn't be throwing inside. But that is a crazy game. You know, you got the brawl, you got him. I think he was throwing the bat at Hawk Harrelson or something in the booth, and it went up on the screen. It seems like there's actually some people out for blood. Tensions were really high, which, again, as a baseball fan, I love nothing more. So it was very fun, the whole thing.
By the end of that season, Bobby wasn't as effective as he had been in the past. He did save 30 games, but his ERA doubled to 3.5. It was a 1.15 ERA plus. He was dealing with pain, and some people blamed the overuse from the prior season on that. But whatever the reason, 1991 was pretty much the last year where he was an effective full-time closer. In 1992, he saved 22 games, but his ERA rose to 4.75. So in 1993, the Sox replaced him with Roberto Hernandez.
Bobby was mostly used in blowouts, and he said, "I didn't adjust to pitching in a non-competitive situation." He knew that his role was different and that he wasn't as effective as he had been, and the Sox ended up trading him to Philadelphia for Jose De Leon, and it didn't go well. Bobby had an ERA over 6 in 17 appearances, but he did get to appear in the playoffs for the first time, pitching in the NLCS and the World Series for the Phillies. He pitched in 4 playoff games, all of them losses, and he gave up a 3-run homer down 5-0 in NLCS Game 2 that really blew that game open. But the other 3 appearances, he held opposition scoreless. And this was the only postseason action of his career. After that season, he tried to catch on with Seattle in 1994, but gave up 8 runs in just under 8 innings and was released. He signs an NPB for the Fukuoka Hawks and spent the rest of 1994 and all of 1995 there, regaining his form with a 1.94 ERA with 20 saves over 53 appearances. He really enjoyed his time there, felt like he was well-treated, but then his back blew out. He went back to the States to try to fix it.
In 1996, he tried to come back one more time with the Sox and was ready to pitch at AAA, but after a month, he felt something snap, and it was a displaced vertebra. So he had to have plates and screws attached to his spine, which ended his career, closing the book on Bobby Thigpen 9 seasons in the major leagues, 448 games, a record of 31 wins and 36 losses, a 3.43 ERA, which is a 1.19 ERA plus, and 201 saves. One All-Star game, and one Rolaids Relief Man Award. How about in retirement?
Bobby coached high school ball for 10 years. He appears at fantasy camps and spent 6 years in the minor leagues coaching as well, managing the Bristol White Sox, the Class A Winston-Salem, and Double A Birmingham White Sox. And then the White Sox named him their bullpen coach in 2013. And he was with Chicago through 2016. And now he's a grandpa. He has five little ones and spends his time hunting and fishing. He did have a really bad injury in 2003. He was at a Tampa Bay Lightning hockey game and he slipped and fell on the stairs. Thinking he just had some bruises, he declined medical attention. And then when he felt some further discomfort, he went to the hospital. And it turned out he injured his spleen and had internal bleeding, and this required surgery. He fully recovered, but at one point he was in really bad condition and had something like a gallon of blood inside him. But he has fully recovered from that.
So, David, we've looked at Bobby Thigpen a little bit closer. This is a player and a team that you followed closely as a kid, but now that we've looked a little bit more at him, what do you think?
As a player, Bobby was a 2020 Mississippi State Hall of Fame inductee. His Major League Baseball saves record was broken, but it lasted 18 years. The role of the closer changed so much, and guys have 50 saves every now and again. It still doesn't happen all that often, only 17 times. His 57 saves was broken by K-Rod Francisco Rodriguez in 2008 when he saved 62 games. Among those 17 pitchers with 50-plus saves in a season, Bobby had the fifth-best ERA plus and fourth-best wins above replacement for his 57 save season. So a lot of your mileage as a closer depends on your team and opportunities, but you have to take them when they're given, and you only have limited innings to do it. So Bobby at that time in 1990 made the most of those innings and made the most of those appearances. He still holds the White Sox all-time save record with 201. All-time among closers in their first six seasons, he is fifth in saves after Craig Kimbrell, Trevor Hoffman, Jonathan Papelbon, and Dan Quisenberry. In the love to face section, the following Hall of Famers really struggled against Bobby Thigpen. Cal Ripken Jr. went 4-for-19, Robin Yount 4-for-19, George Brett 1-for-15, Kirby Puckett 2-for-13, Eddie Murray 1-for-9. So some of the best batters in the American League really struggled in high pressure situations against Bobby Thigpen. As a guy, in that 1988 Tribune piece, May Lou, Donna Joe's friend, was asked, "You writing a story about good people for your Chicago newspaper on the holiday? You've come to the perfect place." And she was talking about Donna Joe, but could have just as well been talking about Bobby Thigpen. His best friend since community college is a guy named Pete Francis, who played baseball with him. And he said, "People always ask me if Bobby's success is hard for me to take. And it surprises me because if there's anyone in this world who deserves to make it in baseball, it's Bobby. He never got a big head about it. He never forgot where he came from. And really, he hasn't changed a bit." When he broke the saves record, Bobby said it was a nice feeling, a nice accomplishment. Donna Joe had a modest living when Bobby was growing up, at best. They didn't have much money. And Donna Joe said, "When Bobby went to college and started bringing buddies back home with him, my friends would say, 'What are you going to do about this place, Donna Joe? You're going to have Bobby's friends thinking he grew up in a barn?'" Donna Joe said, "Well, it's no mansion we live in, but I'm not ashamed of it. It's home. It's all I've got. And besides, you can't buy the one thing we've got, and that's love." So Donna Joe raised Bobby. Bobby seems like a pretty good dude. Matt, your thoughts about Bobby and his place in White Sox history and his place in Las Comiskey?
Yeah, I mean, that was really touching what you just read. I didn't know all that. Bobby Thigpen talked about how coming to Chicago was beyond his wildest dreams, that he came from a small town, and when he came to Chicago, he couldn't believe he was pitching in the big city, kind of thing. So he was very much a modest person who was not arrogant, and that's a part of the reason why you like him so much. And to me, he was the biggest star on my favorite White Sox team of all time. And you're talking about his numbers, and I'm a big numbers guy too. I love the backs of baseball cards, and I look at stats all day. But I think there's intangibles that need to be considered for that 1990 team. And one of them is that he did get more opportunities than others, and that's part of the reason he got to 57. But something to remember is he didn't just break the record. He shattered the record, and he almost created a new standard for how many saves you could hope for. It was a huge leap. And then the other piece is to think through all those one run games and how much pressure that is when you're in a pennant race the entire year and you're going out there on a regular basis. And I talked to him a little about nerves. Were you nervous? And he said, yeah, I was nervous every time I went out there. The batter was nervous too, but you know, you try to use that nervousness for energy to make you even better. But I think things that don't come through in the stats is that game in and game out with all those save opportunities, he went out there with super high intensity, battling those nerves and pitching as well as he did. It's too bad what happened with his back, because I think he could have pitched a lot longer and had a longer career, but we'll always have that 1990 season, and he was a great teammate as well.
Well, thank you so much for that, Matt, and thank you very much for joining us on the show. Where can folks find The Last Comiskey, and how can they support your work?
Yeah, so you can find all three parts of our documentary, Last Comiskey, on YouTube. Our YouTube handle is at Last Comiskey 1990. It's up there for free to watch. Hopefully it'll be up there forever as long as YouTube is a thing. Then we also have our Twitter, at Last Comiskey. And throughout the summer, we'll be posting some outtakes from our interviews. And I hope that Mike and I can post some of the outtakes from the Thigpen interview, because some of these stories are really cool. We're going to be having an event May 13th at the Promontory in Hyde Park, where we're going to have a number of players there for an FAQ and show some of the documentary, and all of the proceeds from that event will go to the Pediatric Epilepsy Surgery Alliance, which is a nonprofit that I do a lot of work for. So we're continuing this for a while. We're going to keep things coming out and some events as well.
Excellent. Well, we'll be sure to have links and all that information in the show notes. And thanks again for joining us. Thank you, David, for the story today. And thank you to you at home. If you're heading over to May Lou's house to watch the game on a satellite, tell us all about it on Twitter. We're at Tops1988. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.